Chapter 22. Summers went online yet again. He should have had a response to his last message by now. It was understood by all that the plan would take some time, but something should be happening by now. It shouldn't be taking so damn long. Back in Chicago, he'd put everything he had on the table. All in for one last deal. Things should be moving forward. If he didn't see something positive in the email account soon, then he'd have no choice but to go back and confront them. Back in his hotel room, he faced another lonely day. Just him and Glenn Livett. He poured a drink and studied the amber liquid. Another day in oblivion. But first, he decided to make a couple of calls to help out an old friend who deserved better than his rude behavior. He dialed Pacific Properties and asked for Mr. Nakamura.
"Hello?" said a tinny voice. "This is Nakamura."
"Mr. Nakamura," Jack said. "This is Oliver Everett of the firm of Gladstone and Finchley. We represent Marcy Grant."
"Oh, good. You get her out, I waive the penalty."
"Quite the contrary, sir. If you withdraw the suit immediately, we won't seek fees and costs against you, and we won't report you to the Department of the Prosecuting Attorney for the City and County of Honolulu."
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about filing a suit for summary possession without the statutory 5-day notice. The suit is defective, and you know it."
"She didn't pay rent on time. The lease says pay on the first."
"And Hawaii revised statute, section 521-68, requires a landlord to serve a 5-day written notice of non-payment, during which time the tenant may pay the rent or move. Filing suit without serving notice is considered an unfair and deceptive trade practice. Besides, Ms. Grant tendered the rent to you on February 3rd.
"Maybe she did and maybe she didn't."
"Can you prove it?" "Are you an attorney?"
"No. I am the president of Pacific Properties, Inc. We own the house."
"Hmm. Now that raises another illegal situation. Are you aware that a corporation cannot act on its own behalf in court? Since a corporation is a non-corporeal entity, it can only speak through its human representatives. It can't represent itself and must have a spokesperson. And in a courtroom, that spokesperson must be a licensed attorney. By filing the suit and signing the complaint, you have violated Hawaii Revised Statute Section 605-14, engaging in the unauthorized practice of law."
"Wait, no, what?"
"I'm afraid I will have to contact the Department of the Prosecuting Attorney. Two serious offenses here, engaging in a deceptive trade practice and the unauthorized practice of law. Very serious indeed, Mr. Nakamura."
"Wait, no, we could, you know, we could work something out. You tell her I'll let her stay this time. I'll tear up the papers. She doesn't have to come to court."
"That's not good enough, Mr. Nakamura. The continued existence of this unjustified lawsuit is a blemish on her fine reputation. I want you to go directly to the courthouse and non-suit this case. Obtain an immediate order of dismissal. Then I want you to take a copy of that order and deliver it to Ms. Grant's residence this afternoon. Unless she calls me by 5 p.m. and tells me that the case is dismissed, well, I will have to do what I have to do. Understand?"
Yeah, I'll do it.
But there's something else. I charge $600 an hour, and I've spent 2 hours so far on this matter. What should we do about that?"
"She don't have to pay the rent this month."
"Nice talking to you, Mr. Nakamura." Jack smiled. One down. He took a card out of his pocket and dialed another number.
"Hawaii Magazine, this is Milani Chen."
"Hello, Milani, this is Jack Montgomery. You sat next to me on the plane." She giggled.
"The man with the soft shoulder. How are you enjoying Hawaii?"
"Very well. I may even decide to live here. I wonder if I may be so bold as to impose upon you for a small favor."
"Well, you didn't mind being bold on the airplane."
She laughed.
"What do you need?"
"I ran into an old friend of mine yesterday. She's a wonderful freelance photographer who moved to Hawaii several months ago. I wonder if you'd take a look at some of her work. No promises, you don't have to like any of it. But she can't even get in the door of any of the local publications. It would mean a lot to her just to have someone look."
"Absolutely. Have her call me." "She's right about not getting in the door. It's a very close-knit circle out here. Very tough to break in. But I'm always looking for a good freelancer."
"Thanks a million, Milani. You can use my shoulder anytime." She laughed.
Jack, a few of us are getting together after work today at Roland's. If you're free, why don't you drop by?
I have a meeting this afternoon, but if I can break away, I will. Thanks a lot, Milani.
Summers set the phone down and returned to his solitude. He sat by the window watching a delivery man wheel a dolly of beer into the corner bar. He felt good about giving Marcy a hand, helping her out. Back in Chicago, Marcy had been a good friend. More than a good friend. She'd been there at the end. His thoughts reeled him back to that last day. To the poignancy. The sweetness. The profound sadness that would forever change all of their lives. Back to the hospital room. Alina, her voice weak, almost a whisper, beckoned Jack closer to her pillow.
Ask Marcy to bring me my makeup. Tell her that I would ask one more favor of her. I would like her to come in here, clean me up, and make me look the best she can. I need to say goodbye to Sophie, and I don't want her to remember me like this.
Don't talk like that, Jack protested, but Alina waved him off.
We both know what's going on here, Jack. The doctors told us that my liver, my kidneys, have all but shut down. They've stopped working. I'm in a lot of pain, sweetheart, and I'm only alive because of that machine, and who knows for how much longer. Please let me say goodbye to my daughter in the right way. Just the two of us. Do that for me.
He nodded and bent over to give her a kiss. His throat tightened.
Oh, honey, I'm gonna miss you so much. And I'll miss you too. But Sophie, she's a part of each of us. Our little butterfly, part me and part you. All of the love we shared will live on in Sophie.
Alina patted his hand.
Go to Marcy.
Marcy rose to the task magnificently, with all the skill and love she could muster. When she had finished, she returned to the hall and nodded to Jack. He led Sophie into the room where Alina lay propped up on her bed. Though thin and drawn, she looked radiant. Her hair was styled. There was color in her cheeks. Marcy had worked magic. Jack lifted Sophie onto the bed and left the room, closing the door behind him, leaving the two of them lying there, locked in a hug. After a while, Sophie pushed the door open and walked into the hall. Her eyes were red, but she was composed. She walked straight to Jack, who knelt on the floor.
Mommy's going to live with God, she said. She can't live with us anymore.
They cried together. Later that day, Jack honored Alina's wish to turn off the machines. He lay beside her, holding tightly to her as she left.
And flights of angels sing thee to thy rest,
he'd whispered in her ear. Soon the doctor came into the room.
May I have just a few minutes more?
The doctor nodded sympathetically. Take all the time you want. He'd said his goodbyes and made his promises. What Alina and Sophie had discussed was private and special to them, but Alina told him that she felt confident, secure in her belief that she could leave and the two of them would carry on, that they'd be just fine. Jack could count on Sophie to weather the storm.
Be strong for each other,
Alina had said. Then his thoughts returned to Hawaii, to the present and his insufferable dilemma. He looked at his glass of scotch. He shook his head.
I can't do this again today. I'm not doing myself any good. I can't give in to another day of self-pity. Alina would be ashamed of me. Be strong, she'd say. Get out of your damn quagmire, she'd say. And I know what she'd tell me to do.
He picked up the phone. Are you busy?
It's raining, Jack.
Does that mean you're busy?
Sure does. There are rainbows all over the island. This is a photographer's canvas. I might even find the pot of gold.
Do you want company, Marcy? I'm not doing anything.
Silence for a moment. You'd have to stand in the rain, she finally said. Why don't we make it some other time?
I don't mind the rain.
I don't know, Jack. The other night ended kind of rough for me. You know, cab fare on the table.
I know. I'm really sorry. Again. But I'm a very good rainbow spotter.
Every bone in my body tells me there are insurmountable issues here.
There are. So, can I see you?
Well, if that's what you want. I'm all the way over at Kahana Bay on the windward coast. Do you know how to get here?
I'll find it. Kahana Bay.
If you're serious about coming, bring hiking shoes. I'll meet you on the beach.
He laid the phone down and wondered if it was a mistake. She was good medicine for his melancholy. But when she brought up the memories, it was heart-rending. And he felt himself leaning on Marcy. He feared another dependency. He was determined not to get close to anyone until Sophie was returned, but truth be told, he craved Marcy's company. They had a mutual foundation of affection, a history. They had a bond. Summers parked his car in the lot near the beach. A warm and gentle rain continued to fill the air. From time to time, the bright sun would peek through breaks in the clouds and send shafts of light sideways to the hills and vertically into the sea. Kahana Bay's crescent-shaped beach was bordered by steep hills, foothills to the Ko'olau Range, painted dark green by the ironwood trees. He found Marcy standing in the sand, pointing her camera at rainbows forming over the Ko'olau's.
"Those your hiking shoes?"
She pointed to his sandals. He shrugged.
"Well, follow me and be careful not to slip."
She stuffed her equipment into her backpack and headed to a trail that disappeared into the rainforest and up the mountainside. Jack scrambled after her. The trail bordered the Kahana Creek and serpentined its way up several hundred feet above the bay. Soon they arrived at the base of a waterfall that splashed into a clear pool. Marcy pointed.
"At the top of that waterfall, there's another freshwater pool fed by yet another waterfall. One to another, like a slinky, all the way from the top."
They resumed their climb up the slippery, mossy trail, but Jack's sandals couldn't hold a grip and slid out from under him. He fell belly first onto the muddy trail. Marcy tried to muffle a burst of laughter.
"Would you get mad if I said, 'Down goes Randy'?"
Jack had to admit it was funny, and realized he had made the right decision when he'd called her. No doubt Marcy brought the right medicine to brighten his day. A prepackaged effervescence, and coming out from under clouds of depression could only help him think more clearly.
"You're better off barefoot. You can't climb in those sandals."
A few hundred feet more, and they stopped to survey the scene. Broad philodendron leaves bordered the lush forest. Bushy ferns, 3 to 4 feet high, were abundant. Small flowers popped out of the forest floor. Marcy knelt in a clearing and snapped close-ups of orange canna flowers. Then she stood and pointed down at the bay, where the clear turquoise waters lapped against the white sand beach.
"Right here's a shot I've taken many times. Looks like a scene from Mutiny on the Bounty or Pirates of the Caribbean, doesn't it? It's as pretty a picture as there is in Hawaii. But I can't sail the prints."
"Why not?"
"Do you see anyone on the beach?"
"No."
"Exactly. As beautiful as it is, serene, idyllic, tourists don't come here. It's a long ride from Waikiki, and the tour buses don't bring them out here. There are no concession stands, no souvenir shops, no commercial kickbacks to the tour bus drivers. Tourists like to buy pictures of places they've seen. They don't come here, so they don't buy my Kahana Bay pictures."
Down at the bottom, back at the beach, Summers said, "Are you hungry? Can I take you to lunch?" She nodded.
"I'm starved, and there's a place out here that I love.
But look at your shirt, Jack. It's all full of mud." He pulled his shirt off, soaked it in the ocean, and wrung it out. "Am I okay now? Do I look presentable enough to accompany a pretty photographer to lunch?" She smiled.
"Follow me."
Jack drove south along Kamehameha Highway and then onto a red gravel road bordered by fields of grapevines on trellises. At the end of the road sat a small chalet with chalk plaster walls and a red tile roof, reminiscent of the Italian countryside and clearly out of its architectural element on Oahu. The hand-painted sign above the door read, "Il Trovatore." "Italian?" Jack said outside the door. "Really, Marcy?
Like I'm all the way from Chicago and you're taking me for Polynesian style of veal parmesan?
Give me your critic's review when you've finished. As far as I'm concerned, it's fabulous. And Giovanni's got his own vineyard.
Inside the entrance on the foyer walls were several framed photographs, including one that Jack immediately recognized. Kahana Bay. I thought you said you couldn't sell these.
We have a barter arrangement.
A red-cheeked man with a hearty smile came out of the kitchen, wiping his hands on a stained apron.
Marcita, benvenuto.
He wrapped his arms around her.
Gio, this is Jack, a friend from the mainland.
Gio's handshake was happy, warm, and exaggerated.
Come in, come in.
I thought maybe your name might be Manrico, Jack said. Giovanni raised his eyebrows.
Ah, the troubadour. You know the opera?
I do. Giovanni put his arm around Marcy.
And you are a suitor, my precious Leonora?
Jack furrowed his brow.
Aha, Count de Luna, my rival.
I challenge you to a duel for the love of Leonora. Giovanni laughed.
Ha ha! The fire of jealous love. You're truly a devotee, and the wine today is a gift of the house.
Giovanni brought out two bottles of his estate-grown wine, a Grenache Gris for starters, and a sweeter Muscat of Alexandria. He set five glasses on the table.
Of all the varietals I've tried, these two are my only successes. It's too hot and too wet for anything but southern Mediterranean wines.
He poured three glasses of Grenache Gris, held one up to the light, admired the ruby color, swirled it, and smiled proudly. Then he waited while Jack and Marcy tasted the offering and bestowed their approbations. He shrugged.
Limiamo.
During lunch, Jack nodded to Marcy.
Pretty damn tasty.
Right up there with Taylor Street. She smiled. I have something for you. Jack pulled out Milani's business card. Give this woman a call tomorrow. She'd like to see some of your work.
Seriously? Hawaii Magazine? Son of a bitch. How did you do that?
He shrugged. I met her on the plane and called her earlier today. Simple as that. But when you call her, you have to tell her you're a friend of Jack Montgomery.
Jack Montgomery? Is that the name you gave her?
Right. She had a look of consternation.
Jack, what's going on?
I can't tell you. Marcy shook her head.
There's a virtual wall between us, Jack, and given our past, it makes me very uncomfortable. You've set all these artificial limits to our conversation, and I don't like them. We have too much history, you and I. Besides, given the way you ditched me at the bar the other night, can I ask, why the hell did you call me today?
I called you because you're my friend. Because I'm in a tough spot. Today was rough, like every other goddamn day, but even more so. And as much as I need to be invisible, I need a friend more. I don't have anyone else to turn to.
Wow.
Marcy took a drink of wine.
As long as we're being honest. I'm a little worried about getting too close to you. You've obviously got some scary things going on. I have the feeling you're not out here on business. And Jack, as your good friend, I'm worried about you. Why aren't you home with Sophie?
Jack leaned across the table.
Hold on to yourself, Marcy. I'm not home with Sophie because she's gone.
Marcy's face froze in shock. Her eyes opened wide.
Oh my God.
No, it's not like that. She's alive. But she's been taken from me. She's been kidnapped. Tears formed in Marcy's eyes.
By whom? When?
A few months ago. By Arif.
Arif? Alina's father has her? Is she in Hebron?
Jack nodded. I don't know for sure, but that's my best guess. Now you know why I'm so mysterious. I'm working on a plan to get her back, and I need to be real careful. Before coming out here, I had to do some things. Cross some lines. I had to associate with people who may not be doing things above board. So, I had to drop out of sight. You don't want to get involved in this mess. Let's keep it that way.
You called me today, not the other way around.
I know, sometimes need trumps wisdom.
What does Arif say? Did you call him?
He changed his numbers. I can't reach him.
If Sophie's in the Middle East and you know where she is, why are you going through mobsters? Why don't you go get her yourself? Hell, I'll go with you.
Well, first of all, who said they were mobsters? They're just some guys with connections. And as to going into Hebron and rescuing Sophie myself, that's a near impossible task and a last-ditch effort. Hebron's a violent, dangerous city. It's a Palestinian stronghold, and Arif's well-protected. It would be a risk not only to me, but to Sophie as well. I'm not saying I won't do it as a last resort. But right now my plan calls for me to wait here while others do their part. One day I'll tell you all the details.
One day, my ass. You're talking to Aunt Marcy.
She stood.
You can't leave off in the middle of the story. I want to know these details.
She turned and waved at Giovanni.
Let's see if I can talk Gio into giving us another bottle of Grenache. We'll take it back to my place. At least I can say it's my place for a few more days.
Chapter 23. Catherine sat at her dining room table. Stacked before her were 2,400 pages of trial transcripts from, in regards to, the guardianship of Sophie Summers. The trial, which began in August 2012, lasted 6 days. They started with reports from the agencies. Jack took the stand on the afternoon of the third day and faced grilling cross-examination from Al-Zahani's lawyer. Catherine flagged certain pages of his testimony. By Jerome Gibbs.
Mr. Summers, after your daughter Sophie was born, did your wife continue to work?
John Summers. Not as a social worker. After Sophie was 3 or 4 months old, she returned to teaching piano.
In the home?
That's right.
In the 5 years of Sophie's life, did your wife ever have a job outside the home?
What's your point?
I'll ask the question, sir, if you don't mind. Did she work outside the home at any time after Sophie was born?
No.
And you, sir? Am I correct that you have been an attorney at the firm of Jenkins and Fairchild the entire time that Sophie's been alive?
That's correct.
How many hours did you bill last year?
Billable? Just about 2,000.
Is that in line with what Jenkins and Fairchild requires of its attorneys?
Pretty much.
Are you also required to log non-billable hours?
Yes. Client development, community involvement, bar association activities.
And don't you have to spend several hours in continuing legal education to keep your license?
Yes, about 20 a year.
Altogether, Mr. Summers, how many total hours did you report to Jenkins and Fairchild last year?
I'm not sure, about 2,400.
Oh, I think it was 2,714, wasn't it?
That could be right.
Now, if my math is correct, that amounts to 226 hours per month, correct?
If you say so.
And taking away the holidays and vacation time, that would be about 50 hours per week. Am I right?
If you say so, I haven't done the math.
And would you agree with me, sir, that some of the hours that you spend at the office in a day just aren't billable or recordable at all? I mean, you have lunch, right? Occasionally get a cup of coffee?
Witness is silent.
Sir?
That's right.
Oh, and let's not forget commuting. How long does it take you to get to work?
Half hour.
So we're really talking about 60 more hours a week that you're away from the home. Right?
I guess so.
And that's pretty much been your habit for the last 5 years, hasn't it?
Witness nods.
During the time that Sophie was growing up, and you were putting in your 60 or more hours per week, who was caring for the child?
My wife.
Exactly. Did she make her breakfast?
Yes.
Get her off to school?
Yes.
Make her lunch and dinner?
Yes.
Bought her clothes, took her to the park, read her the bedtime stories?
By Judge Carr.
Counsel, we get the idea. Move on.
By Mr. Gibbs.
Mr. Summers, are you still working at Jenkins and Fairchild?
Yes.
Now that you don't have a wife to assume the entire responsibility of raising your child, are you still putting in your 60 hours a week?
No, I work fewer hours.
Well, I have your report for the last 30 days. May we mark this as an exhibit, please?
Exhibit is marked.
Did you log 220 hours last month?
Yes, but it was. How many Saturdays did you work?
That's not fair. I had a large transaction to close. And how many, Mr. Summers?
Two.
And two Sundays?
Yes, but that's a sufficient answer, sir.
Did you enroll Sophie in daycare?
Preschool.
I did. Does she go every day?
Weekdays.
Isn't it true that for weeks and weeks, Sophie cried hysterically when you dropped her off at daycare?
Witness is silent.
Mr. Summers?
There were some adjustment problems we had to work through.
She clung to you at the door and begged you not to leave her, didn't she?
Damn you, Gibbs, her mother had died.
She was only 5!
Whereupon a break was called.
By Mr. Gibbs.
Getting back to the daycare.
Did the director of the facility recommend that Sophie seek professional help?
I was already bringing her to a child psychologist.
A 5-year-old girl in psychotherapy?
Her mother had died, you bastard.
By Judge Carr.
Settle down, Mr. Summers.
By Mr. Gibbs.
Are you in therapy as well?
Yes.
Let's move on to a different subject, Mr. Summers. Let's talk about your wife. Was she in therapy?
No, never.
Would you say she was well-adjusted?
Absolutely.
Kind, loving?
Absolutely.
Would you describe her as a happy woman?
Yes, I would. And so would everyone that knew her.
Was she a good mother?
Yes.
Was she a good wife to you?
The best.
By Judge Carr.
Would you like some water, Mr. Summers?
Whereupon a break was called.
Did your wife possess all the skills necessary to make a happy home for you and your daughter?
Without question.
In fact, isn't it true that you would love for Sophie to grow up to be just like her mother?
Yes, I would.
Would you agree with me that Dr. and Mrs. Alzahani did a first-rate job raising Alina Alzahani?
Alina was a wonderful woman.
No further questions.
Catherine's concentration was broken as Liam walked into the room. How do you like working for Walter Jenkins again, Cat?
He said as he slipped off his coat.
Catherine gave him an angry squint.
I don't work for him. J&F has engaged my professional services. I work for Catherine Lockhart, attorney at law.
Liam smiled. Take it easy. I didn't mean to rile you up. I know you went by the office today. I'm only asking how it was.
Weird. To tell you the truth, I did not like being there. It brought back all the bad memories of my separation 2 years ago. I could see Walter sitting in my office, ordering me to withdraw from Ben's case because suing Elliot Rosenzweig was too offensive to his big insurance clients. I remembered the day I came to pack up my office, and he arrogantly barged in and tried to pay me off. A huge bonus if I dropped Ben's case.
So why are you back there?
If you recall, I wasn't going to. Then you told me the story about Jack and Alina, and it brought back my memories of Jack Summers. I didn't know him well, but from what I knew, I just can't believe that he stole that money. And then, when Walter sat in my office and begged me to take the case, I don't know. I had a lot of friends back at J&F. They're personally on the hook for $38 million. I thought I could help.
Liam patted the couch. Sit down. I have some information for you.
I spent the afternoon with Jeff Miller at the FBI office.
Miller is the agent assigned to the case.
Catherine headed toward the kitchen.
Would you like a beer?
I'll never say no to that.
Liam raised his voice to be heard in the kitchen.
Miller told me that Summers never went to Brazil. He checked in at O'Hare, went through security, he even scanned his boarding pass, but he never went through immigration in Rio. There are no records of his passport being swiped.
Catherine came back into the room with a bottle of Blue Moon for Liam and a frosted glass of Corona for herself. She set them on the coffee table and curled her feet underneath her on the corner of the couch next to Liam.
Maybe Summers had a fake passport, or a forged passport in someone else's name?
Nope. They checked the videos around the time the Chicago flight arrived. He didn't enter the country.
Does Miller have any idea where he went?
If he does, he's not telling me.
Israel?
Liam shook his head. Tel Aviv airport security has facial recognition software. They're pretty sure he hasn't landed in Israel.
Maybe he could change his looks. False papers.
Cat. This guy's a transactional lawyer. He's not Jason Bourne.
Do they think he has the money?
They're not sure he does, but they think he's involved. And they're positive there must be others. After all, at least one of the direct participants is dead.
Harrington went missing the day after the theft, and his body was fished out of the lake.
Could Summers be dead as well?
Possibly, but again, his body hasn't turned up, so who knows?
Given Summers' profile, the FBI doesn't think he's a murderer. Miller is convinced that Summer was an enabler and that someone else was pulling his strings.
What else did he tell you?
That's all he would say. They have more going on, but it's all secretive. He wants to set a meeting for us at J&F tomorrow. He has someone for us to meet.
So that's why Walter called me, she said.
Right, 10 a.m. tomorrow, it'll be you, me, Walter Miller, and the other guy he's bringing.
Who's he bringing?
He wouldn't say, but he doesn't want me to talk to anyone else until after the meeting.
Catherine shrugged. Well, I guess we'll find out tomorrow.
She took a sip of her beer.
Liam turned to face her. He leaned over to put his arm around her and gave her a kiss. Catherine looked at him as though something was on her mind. Liam, I've been thinking a lot about our talk the other night at Cafe Sorrento. And you know what I can't get out of my head? That quote from Julius Caesar. The one that hung on Alina's wall. About the tide. Do you suppose there's always such a moment in relationships?
Liam took a gulp of beer.
You mean for you and me?
For our relationship?
Are you talking about when we were in college that we should have run off together like Jack and Alina did? That maybe I should have grabbed the moment? I suppose that could have been what I was thinking, but it wasn't. That's ancient history. I was really thinking about more current times.
But we did, didn't we? I mean, we took it at the flood. We got together again after all these years.
Well, we did, but... And we're doing great.
Aren't you happy with the way things are?
I'm not unhappy, Liam. That's not the point. It's about more than just doing great. I mean, is this the way you want to keep things? Just being together?
Liam shrugged.
Why not?
She stood, turned her back, and walked to the kitchen.
Catherine, did I say something wrong?
Liam rose from the couch and followed her.
Wait a minute, okay? I get it. We're not getting any younger. The talk about families, the talk about relationships, about you and me. Am I right? Work with me here, you know I'm a little dense. You want to talk about things? I can talk. We can talk.
Catherine shook her head.
Jesus, Liam, never mind. Come on, Cat. I didn't mean to be flip.
Liam walked behind her into the kitchen.
I just didn't want to push things, you know? You had a bad marriage, and maybe... Maybe what? That I never want to marry someone ever again?
Liam put his palm on his forehead.
I'm not going to get out of this in one piece. I just didn't want to push it, that's all. Things are going well, so I didn't want to upset the apple cart. Look, my marriage to Peter was a failure because I let him and his fast, jet-set style change me. Not because I can't carry off a marriage. I let the most shallow of indulgences, possessions, parties, social circles, become important in my life. I wasn't myself then, Liam. That's why my marriage failed.
Your marriage failed because Peter was a crook and a philanderer.
It wasn't just that. I had lost my moral compass. But I'm me, Cat. And we're good for each other. We can talk about getting married anytime you want to. Thanks for the reassurance. What do you want for dinner?
Was that your pocket veto?
She shook her head in exasperation.
Dinner, Liam, what do you want to do about it? I don't care. Liam left the room to finish his beer. After a while, he brought the empty bottle back into the kitchen and flipped it into the recycle can. Before the meeting came up, I was planning on going down to Louisville tomorrow. Is it derby time already? Liam smiled. Not for 3 months. I was going to go down to pay a visit to Summers' sister. Did you make an appointment? Liam shook his head. She refused to talk to the FBI. She told Miller that she knew her rights and she didn't have to talk to him and he'd better not come back to her house without a court order. I didn't think she'd want to talk to me either. But you're planning on going down there? Right. I might catch her off guard. Put on me Ulster charm. No woman can resist. Catherine smiled. It always works on me. She walked over and gave him a kiss. I do love you, you know. Chapter 24. Lubana walked quietly into the living room.
She's finally asleep, Arif. I sang to her. Every lullaby I know. She's very unhappy. She'll get over it. Earlier tonight, I asked her again to play the piano. I took her downstairs, put a pillow on the bench, just like we used to do for Alina. I showed her the music that Alina played. It even had heart on the page that Alina drew when she was 6. It only made her sadder. Sophie says she will only play her own piano, at her own home in Chicago. And then she cries because she misses her mother and father. It's so sad.
She'll get over it.
I do not mean to question your wisdom, Arif, but I worry that we have done the wrong thing, taking her away from her home. She begs me to go home. Talk to Jyoti, she says, and tell him to take me back to my daddy. She cries and cries and clings so tightly to her stuffed bear.
You do not mean to question my wisdom, but you question my wisdom. She'll get over it. And that bear, I think we should remove it. The bear reminds her of her life in America. It is too strong a connection.
Lubana put her hands on her hips.
Now I draw the line. If you throw away her bear, she will be inconsolable. What are you trying to do, drive her to hysteria?
No. I'm trying to raise Sophie as I would have raised Alina. Alina was lost to me. My only child. My only descendant.
Sophie is the only one left of our bloodline, Lubana.
Does that mean nothing to you? Are the Al-Sahanis merely to disappear from the earth? No, Lubana. She will become what Alina would have been. What Alina should have been.
She is not Alina, Arif.
Alina is... Stop, woman! I will not have this argument! Sophie will be raised in our home as our daughter. Out of respect for you, I will not destroy her bear. At this time.
Al-Sahani stood and walked toward the door.
I have a meeting. I'll be back late. Do not wait up.
The group of 10 met at the apartment. By previous agreement, they arrived several minutes apart and from different directions. When they were finally assembled, Nizar said,
So? Will you follow this time, Rami?
Not that I am aware. I did not see the woman, but who knows with the IDF? We have 7 weeks left,
Faiz said.
Is the warehouse secure?
It is ideal. One of 1,000 identical warehouses in Jerusalem, but with a locked cold storage vault and an inside garage, Ahmed said.
And what about the bags? What is our progress?
On schedule,
Al-Sahani answered.
That will not be a problem. The bus and the deliveries, those are our only problems.
What about the tour bus?
A beauty to behold. Safe in the garage, it needs only stenciling. Undetectable from the Israeli tour bus. But we still have plenty of time before we switch them,
Rami said.
What about a practice run?
Nizar said.
There will be no practice run,
Faiz said.
The bus, the bags, they will go out as scheduled.
Chapter 25.
Selection Sunday is only 2 weeks away, Victor,
George said, trying to keep his voice loud enough to be heard in the noisy arena.
Where do you think we'll be slotted?
Kelson shrugged. Maybe Midwest. I think the Deeks will probably be a second or third seed. Tough one tonight, though. MSU was on an 11-game winning streak. They stood as the color guard carried the flags to center court for the national anthem, and the arena grew silent. George removed his blue deacon's cap and placed it over his heart. He leaned over and whispered to Kelson,
"You think we'll cover 3 points tonight?"
Kelson smiled and shrugged. "Giving us three on our home court is a pick'em. I stayed away, George."
"Even from the over and under?"
Kelson smiled again.
"That's a different story."
After dinner, Catherine sat at the table and resumed reading the trial transcript. On the fourth day, Al-Zahani took the stand to testify on behalf of Lubana and himself. Once again, Catherine flagged certain sections of the testimony. Direct examination by petitioner's attorney, Jerome Gibbs.
"Doctor, please say your name for the court record."
"Dr. Arif Al-Zahani."
"What is your profession, sir?"
"I am a doctor of medicine and a research physician. I have a private practice in Hebron, in general medicine. I am on staff at Al Aliyah Hospital in Hebron, a teaching hospital, the government hospital."
"Am I correct, sir, that you were formerly chief of staff at your hospital?"
"That is correct, although we did not call it that."
"Have you practiced at any other hospital?"
"I've practiced at the Islamic Charitable Hospital in Jerusalem, and for a while at the Augusta Victoria Hospital in Jerusalem, but no longer."
"And your wife, Lubana, what is her profession?"
"Lubana was a nurse many years ago. She stopped working when we had our only child, Alina. She stayed at home, raising our daughter, making her dinners, teaching her, nurturing her. She was an excellent mother."
"Calling your attention, doctor, to October 2011, did you have occasion to hire a private investigation firm?"
"Yes. I became concerned for my granddaughter's welfare. When I was in Chicago for my daughter's funeral, I could see that John Summers was emotionally disturbed, and I was worried about Sophia's safety."
By Harold Fine.
"Objection to the witness rendering an opinion on the mental condition of my client."
Witness.
"Do not question my credentials, sir. I am a licensed doctor, and have completed a rotation in psychiatry."
Judge Carr.
"I'm assuming it's not offered as an expert opinion, but as a predicate for what happens next. Is that right?"
By Jerome Gibbs.
"Correct, Your Honor."
Judge Carr.
"Then it's overruled on that basis. Move on."
By Jerome Gibbs.
"What were your instructions to the private detective?"
Witness.
"Just to keep an eye on Mr. Summers and Sophie, and report to me. I was really hoping that everything would be okay. That Mr. Summers would get himself together, that we would not have to intervene. But the reports came back very bad. Drugs, alcohol, depression, hysteria. I knew I had to act quickly to protect our granddaughter."
By Harold Fine.
"Objection."
By Judge Carr.
"Sustained. Move on."
Witness.
"But, Your Honor, the report told me that Mr. Summers was in psychotherapy, was on psychotropic medication, was suffering from depression, and as a grandfather I..."
By Harold Fine.
"Objection, objection! This man cannot be allowed to ramble on with hearsay testimony."
Witness.
"I have to protect my grandchild. What is hearsay? I get reports, I get pictures, I know it's true."
By Harold Fine.
"Objection, Your Honor."
Judge Carr.
"Sustained. Doctor, wait until there is a question asked before you speak. And you cannot testify about what someone else said. That's hearsay. You can only testify to what you've seen and heard. Now, Mr. Fine, please sit down. I hear your objections. I understand the hearsay rule. I think I know what's evidentiary and what's not, what I can consider and what I shouldn't. Mr. Gibbs, let's get on with the testimony."
By Jerome Gibbs.
"Doctor, without saying what was in the reports or what you were told, how many reports did you receive?"
Witness.
"One each week for about 8 or 9 weeks. I also talked to my investigators on the phone, and Summers wasn't getting any better. Maybe worse.
by Harold Fine. Objection, Your Honor. Judge Carr. The objection will be sustained. By Jerome Gibbs. After reading these reports and talking to the investigators, what did you do?
I contacted you. I want to take Sophie to my home, where she will be well cared for.
Catherine stretched her legs, poured a cup of tea, and then moved ahead to the part where Al-Zahani was cross-examined by Jack's attorney. By Harold Fine.
Dr. Al-Zahani, on direct, you described a warm and loving home in Hebron. Are you a warm and loving person?
I guess you would have to ask others about that.
No, sir, I'm asking you. Are you a warm and loving person? Tell the judge.
Yes, of course I am.
I mean, you're asking this court to award guardianship of a young 5-year-old girl to you and your wife, 6,000 miles away from her home and her father. Are you truly capable of providing a warm and nourishing relationship?
Absolutely.
Do you expect that you will care for Sophie as warmly and lovingly as you would care for your very own child?
Witness does not answer. Dr. Al-Zahani?
Of course.
As warmly and lovingly, for example, as you treated your daughter Alina?
It is different.
Answer the question, please.
Yes.
Just as warmly.
I said, yes.
Did either you or your wife attend Alina's wedding?
Regretfully, no. I was too busy with my practice to leave the country.
Was your wife busy with her practice as well?
She does not have a practice. She cannot travel without me.
You mean you wouldn't let her?
It is not proper.
Since the wedding, how many times have you visited Alina?
I have not.
Well, all right then. After your daughter had her baby, your grandchild, how many times did you visit?
I did not.
Busy again?
Witness nods.
For 5 years.
You have no idea. There are not many doctors in Hebron. I have a very busy practice.
Do you have a telephone, doctor?
Of course.
How often did you speak to your daughter over the past 8 years?
I don't know.
Isn't it true, sir, that before your wife had her heart attack, you did not see or speak to Alina since she left Palestine 8 years ago?
My wife was writing to her.
And you, sir?
I let my wife write. I was very busy.
Respondent identifies Exhibit Number 1.
I show you a letter we have marked as Respondent's Exhibit 1. Do you recognize the handwriting?
It is Lubana's.
And is that her signature?
Witness nods.
The letter is in Arabic. Would you please read and translate it into English, the first 3 sentences?
Witness is silent. By Harold Fine.
Your Honor, would you please instruct the witness to answer my question?
Judge Carr.
Dr. Al-Zahani, please read and translate the first 3 sentences as requested.
Witness.
My dearest Alina, I have your letter and I am pleased to learn that you and Sophie are doing so well. I have shown your letters to your father, but he will not read them and will not speak of you in our home.
By Harold Fine.
Go on, doctor, read the next sentence.
Maybe in time he will change his mind, but for now he says he has no daughter.
Did you disown your very own daughter?
Witness is silent.
Did you disown your daughter, Alina?
Witness is silent.
Mr. Warm and Loving, did you kick your daughter out of your life? Was she dead to you 8 years before she died? Is that how warm and loving? By Jerome Gibbs. Objection! Objection!
Judge Carr.
Counsel, sit down. The objection is overruled.
By Harold Fine.
You will be to Sophie just as warm and loving? Doctor, are you asking this court to grant you custody so that you can disown Sophie 6,000 miles away from her home if she crosses you?
Witness.
You do not understand. Alina had turned from us. She had rejected us and her Islamic faith. In marrying this man, she had dishonored her mother and me. We raised her. Gave her everything. She was a beautiful pianist. She was a brilliant psychologist, a lovely Muslim woman who ran off with an American who was
a Jew?
A Jew. An American. What does it matter? He was not of our community.
Notwithstanding, I remained devoted to Alina. She was my precious one, but I could not act like nothing happened. When she came to Hebron last summer, when she was back in the house, I tried. We talked. But I knew she had become the wife. I was not mean to her. I was trying. But you were distant, perhaps.
You didn't change your mind.
I did not.
You had no daughter.
Witness is silent.
No further questions.
Catherine shut the transcript binder.
Case over, she said to herself.
Chapter 26.
Catherine and Liam were the last to arrive when they walked into JNF's conference room at 10 a.m. Walter Jenkins and three other people were already seated around the oval conference table, and they stood as Catherine and Liam entered. Walter made the introductions.
I think you know Jeff Miller from the FBI. This is Harry Foster from Washington and Kayla Cummings, his associate.
Washington?
What agency?
Liam said as he shook their hands.
Well, more precisely, you might say we're intelligence analysts, Foster said.
His handshake was firm. His gray hair was thinning but neatly cut. He stood tall in a light gray suit with a dark blue tie.
Langley?
Foster shrugged and gave a nod.
Middle East desk, Mr. Taggart.
Liam. Just Liam. Walter gestured for everyone to sit. Liam pointed across the table to Kayla Cummings, who sat posture perfect in a dark blue suit, lavender blouse, and tri-colored scarf, neatly tucked at the neckline, her hands folded on the table before her. She was exquisite, with dark eyes and warm olive skin. Gold hoop earrings glistened against her black hair.
And may I ask who Ms. Cummings works for?
Liam said.
I'm assigned to the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, Mr. Taggart. I advise the Assistant Secretary and the Undersecretary on policy issues, specifically with regard to Iraq, Iran, Israel, and the territories administered by the Palestinian Authority.
Liam tilted his head at Catherine.
The spooks are here.
Then, leaning forward on his elbows, he asked Foster,
What brings the CIA and the State Department to Chicago on a theft of corporate funds?
Well, the simple answer to that question is Kayla, Foster said. She believes there is a connection between the kidnapping of the Summers child, the missing money, and certain activities she's been following in the Middle East. Although purely theoretical at this stage, there's enough substance to her theories to persuade me to come and talk to you.
I don't understand, Liam said. The theft of the escrow funds is a local issue. How are the Middle East desk and the Department for Near Eastern Affairs involved?
We're here because your corporate embezzlement in Chicago may be earmarked to fund the activities of a group I've been monitoring, Kayla said.
Foster angled his head in Kayla's direction.
Kayla's been trying to build a book on a group of Palestinians, and has convinced me, maybe prematurely, that there's a reason for all of us to get together.
He slid a group of papers across the table to Liam.
But before we go any further, we have to do the formalities. What we discuss here today must be held in the strictest confidence as a matter of national security. Our entire discussion, and any information that flows from our discussion, is classified and must remain confidential. Do we have an understanding in that regard?
Catherine and Liam looked at each other, and then nodded their agreement. Foster pointed to the confidentiality agreements. Catherine and Liam each signed them, and slid them back across the table.
Let's begin with Arif al-Zahani, prominent doctor in the West Bank city of Hebron, Foster said. His family has been well known to us and our British cousins for more than 90 years. Indeed, Arif's grandfather Ibrahim al-Zahani was an adjutant to Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, one of the most belligerent and dangerous men the area has ever produced, a man responsible for countless uprisings and murders. During their tenure, Ibrahim and Amin caused the deaths of dozens of British soldiers and countless civilians, both Jews and Arabs. Arif's father, Hamid al-Zahani, was an officer in the Jordanian army in the 1948 and 1967 wars and was the commandant of the Hebron garrison for 20 years.
Arif operates at a much lower altitude, added Kayla, though I believe he's no less sinister. He's a learned man, a medical doctor and a scientist. He has the respect of his community and others in his profession, even in Jerusalem, where he is lectured on his specialty. He has influence among his people, and he's very wealthy.
How did he obtain his wealth?
Liam asked.
He didn't get it practicing medicine, she said. Even now, he works in a very poor community hospital. Those of us who've been following him believe he's been funded by Hamas out of Gaza, though it may be one of the other extremist groups. There's several operating in Hebron.
Do you have any proof that he's involved in the theft of the escrow funds, or that he's planning to use that money?
Not yet.
You said he has influence among his people. What does that mean? Who are his people? Liam said.
Let me emphasize this, Foster said. We have no solid evidence that he's engaged in any terrorist movements. That's why the agency has thus far refused to devote any assets to him. He shrugged. But then Kayla
broke in.
He's far too clever to lose his professional persona, but I assure you he's waist-deep in terrorism. First of all, he's a lineal descendant of mass murderers. It's in his DNA. His father and his grandfather before him were sworn enemies of peace in the region. For close to 50 years, they were at the core of violent insurrection. Secondly, Arif meets regularly with what I believe is an extremist cell in Hebron. Until recently, some of these men were in Gaza. Others are outspoken Palestinian hardliners. Their activity level indicates that they're planning something. Of that, I'm certain.
And now Al-Zahani has Sophie Summers, Liam said.
Correct,
Kayla said. And we're trying to find her father. Foster nodded.
Correct again.
Do you believe that John Summers is going to use $88 million to buy his daughter back? Catherine asked.
Kayla shrugged and spread her hands.
That's the jackpot question, isn't it? Is it possible? Sure. If that's what it takes to get his daughter back, why not?
Walter slapped the table.
Never saw it coming. I knew his daughter was reported missing after the grandparents failed to return her. I knew he was using diplomatic channels to try to get her back, but I never suspected he would steal a client's money to pay a ransom. If I thought it was a possibility...
Foster shook his head.
It isn't something you could have anticipated.
Yeah? Tell that to the judge. We're being sued for malpractice because we failed to supervise our attorneys and allowed one of them to steal $88 million from a client. All based on the principle of foreseeability.
Let's not jump to conclusions, Foster said. We've uncovered no evidence of a ransom demand, and we don't know for sure that there's a plan to transfer $88 million or any sum at all to Palestinian hardliners. Again, those are merely working hypotheses. But if there is such a plan in the works, it isn't something we can permit.
Didn't Summers contact the State Department when Sophie was taken?
Catherine said.
Yes, he did.
Foster gestured for Kayla to answer.
At the time, the State Department did everything it could, not just through our agency, but also involving the Department of Homeland Security. DHS immediately put out an alert for all airlines serving the Middle East, referencing a passport bearing Sophie's name or photographic likeness. A yellow notice was issued by Interpol in Paris, but once again, that's only distributed to countries that are Hague Convention signatories. None of the Middle Eastern countries, with the exception of Israel, are signatories.
I seem to remember, somewhere in the back of my mind,
Catherine said,
that there's a parental abduction statute that applies to grandparents as well.
Isn't it enforceable internationally?
There is a statute, and it does apply to grandparents,
Kayla said.
It's called the International Parental Kidnapping Act, IPCA. It's a federal crime and punishable in the United States.
Outside our borders, we have to depend on treaties, and to a great extent, our treaty partners.
Some countries will send the children back because they recognize the Hague Convention on International Child Abduction, but there are many that will not. There's a long list of countries that will not comply with the Hague Convention, and Sophie is not even in a recognized country. The West Bank, the Palestinian territories, the disputed land, whatever you call it, is not a country. It's not a legitimate sovereignty.
I suppose it's a stupid question, but what about our embassy? Couldn't it do anything about getting Sophie returned?
Catherine said. Kayla shook her head.
Our embassy is in Tel Aviv. Hebron, at least the part where Al-Zahani lives, is administered by the Palestinian Authority. The U.S. has no diplomatic relations with the PA. In fact, a couple years ago we sent a diplomatic delegation to the West Bank and it was attacked by Palestinian protesters. So, it's not a U.S. embassy matter. Since the PA is not a Hague signatory and is non-compliant with the Hague Convention, Summers would have to go through the Hebron courts.
In our experience, non-Muslim parents stand very little chance of succeeding in a child custody dispute in the Islamic courts of the Middle East.
Did Sophie's passport turn up? Liam asked.
That's a strange thing, Foster answered. At the time, Summers told us that Sophie didn't have a passport. He never applied for one, and he's right. There are no records of a passport issued to Sophie Summers.
So how did she travel internationally?
It's a mystery.
Liam folded his arms and rocked back in his chair.
But you're not here because of Sophie's abduction.
Well, indirectly, Mr. Taggart, Kayla said. We're concerned about terrorists getting their hands on $88 million. I've noticed increased activity in Dr. Al-Sahani's group. It's like a little beehive. Clandestine meetings in bakeries and empty apartments. They never use cell phones, no emails. The IDF monitors them, but at a distance.
IDF? Walter said.
Israel Defense Forces. Israeli soldiers. They report suspicious activities to Shin Bet, the Israeli Internal Security Agency, and to the Mossad.
What is the beehive planning?
I don't know, Kayla said. But you can bet Al-Zahani knows.
Like I said before, added Foster, this is Kayla's baby. We haven't yet developed any clear evidence that Al-Zahani is engaged in any terrorist activity. Nothing we can move on. The agency won't staff this operation unless Kayla comes up with something more concrete. But Kayla's so damn passionate and so obsessed with this guy that... Well, that's good enough for me, at least for now. She's been right in the past. So even if she can't get the agency's formal attention, she's got mine. Enough to let her investigate it further.
Let me see if I understand our respective positions, Catherine said. While our purpose is to locate Summers, recover the money, and protect the law firm from bankruptcy, your agenda is to make sure Summers doesn't turn the money over to terrorists.
Precisely, Kayla said.
Where is the money? Liam asked.
Foster shook his head.
Panama? We don't know any more than you do.
And Summers?
No idea.
The CIA and all its agents can't find a transactional lawyer and some stolen money? Walter said.
You watch too many movies.
So tell me, Harry, said Catherine. Why are we all meeting here today?
Well, partly it's about you, Mr. Taggart. As I'm sure you know, Liam's worked for us before.
Foster nodded at Liam.
Liam shrugged.
A long time ago. We'd like to work together again, Foster said. You have the perfect cover. You're a private investigator hired to find a little girl. In that role, you'll be asking a lot of questions. You'll have access to people, become privy to important information, and we'd like to be included.
Liam shook his head.
I haven't been hired to find a little girl. I'm searching for stolen money.
They have a common nucleus.
Well, so far I've learned very little.
I was planning on talking with Summers' sister in Louisville.
She won't talk to you,
Miller said.
She practically threw me out of her house. Told me to get a court order.
Catherine wagged her finger.
Ah, but Liam has his Irish charm. Just ask him.
'Tis true. In any event, Foster continued, a private investigator looking for a missing 6-year-old daughter has a valid reason to ask a lot of questions. Maybe even get close to Al-Zahani. People are sympathetic about a missing child. That activity is unlikely to arouse suspicion. There are places you can go and people you can talk to that we can't.
I'm not looking for his daughter.
Maybe the money is.
Maybe.
So far, I haven't uncovered any proof that Summers has the money or even took the money.
We think he did, Foster said.
I thought you said you didn't know where the money was, Jenkins said.
Oh, we don't. But we know that Summers went to Panama a couple months ago. We traced the missing funds from the escrow account to the First Republic Bank. But the money's not there anymore. First Republic transferred the money to Pacifico Bank. And we've since learned that the money's not there anymore either. That's about all we know.
Walter stood. His face was red.
You people knew all this and said nothing? You knew he went to Panama. My firm is on the brink of collapse, and we're fighting to stay alive. Fuck you! You're the government. You're supposed to work for me.
Calm down, Mr. Jenkins, Foster said. We're trying to get the money back just like you are.
and we don't know where the money is any more than you do.
How did you learn about the money transfers? Catherine said. I thought Panama banking was clothed in secrecy, that even our government couldn't get information.
I can't comment on that.
But you want to use me, Liam said. Have me ask questions and give you the answers.
We use civilian assets all the time, Liam. Just like we did when you were in Ulster. If your world-renowned Irish charm opens a few doors, gives you a lead, all the better. People will talk to a guy trying to find a little girl.
Why do you keep saying, trying to find? We all know where she is. If the government is so concerned that money will be paid to ransom Sophie Summers, why don't you just go to Al-Zahani's house and get her?
Foster had an exasperated look. We don't send the Navy SEALs into a foreign jurisdiction to snatch children in a custody dispute.
Well, Israel does.
Perhaps. But there's more. Right now, Undersecretary Whiting is quietly in Cairo meeting with PA officials. It's an important step in the peace process. We may actually be making some headway after all these years. As you know, the president is planning to travel to the Mideast in a few months, maybe even to make a bold announcement.
Foster smiled patronizingly.
We can't have a terrorist act derailing the peace process.
Liam leaned back. He tapped his fingers on the table. So it's really not about the girl. You don't want her rescued, do you, Kayla? If she were back home, you wouldn't have a reason to poke around. You want to use Sophie as a cover to get close to Al-Zahani and learn more about his little beehive. You hope my snooping around will flush out a terrorist plot.
I don't deny we'd love to have your help, Kayla said. Flush out those terrorists, as you say. But we're not that hard-hearted. If you could bring Sophie home, that would suit us just fine.
Bullshit.
Anyway, that's not why Mr. Jenkins is paying me.
Walter stared hard at Foster.
Are you telling me that if we help get the girl back, he'll help us get the money back? The joint at the hip, Mr. Jenkins. If the money is earmarked to ransom the girl, then the money and the girl converge on the same corner. But let me be candid. We don't know that Summer still has possession of the money. And despite Kayla's theories, we don't know for certain that there's any deal in the works. We only suspect it. Or should I say, Kayla suspects it. But we would agree to assist you in recovering the money. After all, wire fraud is a federal crime.
Wait a minute, Walter said. Taggart doesn't come cheap. Why should I finance the search and rescue of the daughter of a man who stole $80 million from me? The United States government has a lot more money than I do. Why don't you pay Taggart?
If that embezzled money is paid to terrorists, there are a lot of daughters whose lives will be at risk, Kayla said.
I'm not that humanitarian, Walter said.
Well, let me put it another way, Foster said. We'll supply intelligence, you supply the Irish guy. You're looking for your client's funds and you're looking to save your law firm. Can't hurt to have the blessing, not to mention the intelligence resources of the United States government.
Walter looked at Liam and nodded.
I guess your assignment is officially modified. Look, if Kayla's right, Foster said, if there is a deal in the works, then Summers is in more trouble than he knows. He's in way over his head. If he's trying to trade $88 million to the Palestinians for his daughter's return, he's more likely to lose the money and get himself and his daughter killed. After you go to Louisville and talk to his sister, I'd like to meet with you again.
She won't talk to him, Miller said.
Call me when you get back from Louisville, Foster said.